But contemplating this, how desire is, how it, and observing it. I mean, like for a monk, say, you think, I used to come from that, I shouldn't have desires. I've got to get rid of them. And because that was generally how I thought when I became a monk. That was my attitude was you, and how I'd read the scriptures was, you've got to get rid of desire. You're celibate now, and you're a monk with four requisites, robes and bowl, and you should be content with the alms food in your bowl and the robes and get rid of desire. The logic from those ideas was that way. But then his experience is something else, isn't it? It's not a logical thing, but it you find even though you're on four requisites, your desires tend to, you still got this whole habit of desire. So even though you're celibate and your idea of having just robes and bowls, they're very simple things. I found the first couple of years as a monk, I'd become obsessed with my robes and bowl. All the desires that went out and everything would fix on what I could have. So somebody had nicer robes and bowl than I did. Or they have this rule that you can't eat solid food in the afternoon, but they allow sweets, some kind of sweets, but don't have milk in them or anything. So they'd have in Northeast Thailand, and that they didn't have chocolate or anything, all the kind of luxuries they have here, but very basic things of sugar, like granulated sugar. And I'd become obsessed with sugar in the afternoon. I mean, almost like a hungry ghost, looking for a hit of sugar. And when I was a layman, I didn't care about sugar at all. When I was a layman, my desires could cover all kinds of other things. And one thing I could see was that the monastic form, because of its renunciate and its limitation, you'd fix, your desires would still be there, but you wouldn't be desiring something you couldn't have, because something in you could let go of that, because you asked to be a monk, they didn't force you into it, so you're willing to live within the restraint of monasticism, but then the desires are still rampant for the things that you can have. I remember the color of my robe. When they first started allowing chemical dyes, before, when I first ordained, they'd only use the jackfruit dye from a tree, jackfruit trees. And then that was a hard process, to keep dyeing your robes with that. And then they started allowing chemical dyes where you could get nice colors. And I became obsessed with the color of this. I remember thinking in the meditations of how I could get hold of the right amounts of these dyes, get this perfect. But it's through that you begin to really understand desire, and it's not through, one felt embarrassed and guilty about these desires, but the encouragement was to examine rather than to just try to suppress it. So in some ways you could see you need certain margins like sugar, things like this, or things that if it's too ascetic, then it tends to, you don't have a way of examining certain things. And so Buddhist monasticism, Buddha was trying to develop a style between asceticism and indulgence. And it's quite, even though to many people it looks ascetic, it's not really, because we're not into denying or into harmful practices of of just denial of desire and rejection of the world, but in using renunciation as a mirror for all our worldly materialistic habits. Yes? I've contemplated that a lot. And this is just my reflection on it, but one thing I could see that we, I think like we tend to have oftentimes very high standards of what we should be, and so we are always criticizing ourselves because we're never as good as the ideal. That's one reflection. Like I can see, you know, if you want to be a kind, loving, generous person, and then you know, as an ideal, and then you find yourself miserly and mean-hearted, thoughts going through your mind, then you can only hate yourself because you shouldn't, you know, that's bad, and you should be. And people do emphasize, like here in England, I notice people will emphasize and exaggerate their faults. You know, they'll take what's wrong, the thing that's not the flaw that they have, and make a big thing out of it, and then you point out that flaw is relatively minor compared to their virtues, but they're so used to being obsessed with the flaw that they can't even oftentimes see their own virtues, or dismiss it. Also, I think in the basic culture, We tend to see ourselves as, you know, when you look at that kind of cultural development of Europeans from Judaism and Christianity, you get this idea that you're basically corrupt when you're born. You don't have a feeling that you're basically pure. You feel you're, I might be wrong in this, but this is what I mean, how from my experience, you have the feeling you're basically corrupt. Adam and Eve, it's their fault. And it's Eve's fault. Or whatever. And now with feminism, it's Adam's fault. But whoever's fault it is, it happened long ago, and we're the result of it. And so, you know, the idea that you're born in sin is even though maybe your intelligent mind denies that and says, I don't believe that, that is often something that influences the culture underneath. A lot of attitudes and assumptions come from that. So you know, to feel good about yourself is... And I've been reading this book about 14th century Europe and the time of, say, in Britain and in France and Italy, where during the 14th century, when the plague and all these warring factions were taking place, and these flagellants, there were whole groups of people going through Europe, whipping themselves, flagellating themselves, to stop the plague. They thought God was punishing everybody for how bad we are. And this idea of penance for your sins, and that we're sinners and we're bad. And this is very much a... you know, is one way of always feeling guilty. And then in when you ask people like in Asia or Thais or the Dalai Lama, for example, the Dalai Lama was asked about this. He said Tibetan people basically like themselves. They have a basic self-respect. They don't, even though they can be just as bad as any European, and that. But the basic underlying attitude is seeing themselves basically pure, and then they, through their actions, through their greed, hatred, and delusion, they create these impure acts. But the and Thai people are like that also. And so one time we had Tanjau Kun Panyananda here in this very room, very highly regarded Thai monk, elderly monk. And I remember somebody was asking about guilt, asked the same question you asked. And we had to try to translate this guilt into Thai. And Tanjau Kun Panyananda couldn't quite get it. He said, and there was this English monk, Tanjau Sara, who was very good at Thai, and very, really expert, trying to find the right equivalent in Thai for what we mean by guilt here in this country. And so then finally, Tanjau Kun Panyananda couldn't figure out why this was such a problem. He says, well, that's just a minor kind of problem for Thais, just a mental agitation, minor mental agitation, he said. And we said, not here, it's a major. And so then we asked him about how Thai people, not all people, but generally there's a culture, they tend to have a positive image of them, basic image of themselves. Sometimes they see themselves as, they'll say, I'm too lazy to practice, or they'll put themselves down to justify their desire for pleasure and have a good time, getting drunk or doing whatever. But they don't, I don't think the guilt, the obsessive guilt and self-aversion isn't there. And where it is here in England, very strong. And in America, where you hear all these kind of movements now where people have tapes people telling me the other day, they have a way of, you put on this tape when you go to sleep at night, and the tape just affirms that I am a wonderful person, and it goes on all night, and you're sleeping, so you kind of wake up and you think, I'm a wonderful person. Why do you have to do that? Because you don't think you are, really. You have to convince yourself. And because basically the society is saying you're not a very good person. It's generally how you regard yourself. As a child, when you start having bad thoughts. Like I was pretty good, I was always quite a good boy, I wasn't cruel, I didn't like to torture animals or like to torture my sister, but I wasn't that good. I feel really ashamed of myself, what things I used to do to her, but animals, no. My sister and I are now very good friends, but there's a certain sibling rivalry there. But suddenly you find, like I remember, I don't know how old I must have been, about 9 years old, something like that, and I was on a public transport on a bus in Seattle, and an awful thought came into my mind, maniacal thought, really evil thought of wanting to to murder babies. And how I got this thought, you know, it was, you know, for a boy, that's probably about the most evil thing I could think of. And yet, and that came up in my mind. Remember when I was on this bus? I remember feeling terrified of such a thought, thinking, because the logic is only a bad person could think a thought like that. So I must be bad. And so, you know, there's a lot of fear came from that, because then I began to really, you know, mistrust myself and see that there was something very bad about me. But because if a good person would never think that kind of a thought. And in those days, Americans were not into talking about their feelings or anything else. We played, my generation, we played roles, you know. Nothing frightens me. I'm a fearless man. I'm not afraid of anything. And inside you're shaking. Your guts are turning. You say, I'm tough and nobody, I'm not afraid of anybody. You're playing roles and you can't admit to anyone what you're actually feeling. So then in terms of Dhamma, like in you see, like in Buddhism, you see, like a bad thought or a good thought is impermanent. No, I want to help all sentient beings and save all sentient beings from suffering is a thought. Or I want to murder all the babies in the world is a thought. And then you determine to do the good. So you do what is good and you refrain from doing what is bad. So in action and speech, you're choosing to act or not to act. But in terms of Dhamma, you're learning the impermanence of all conditioned phenomena. So you're seeing that even the bad thought is Dhamma. It arises, ceases, it's not self. And that way you break down this sense of guilt that you have, because you aren't as good, or you can't be this idyllic good person as an ongoing, relentlessly unmitigated goodness that you think you should be, and then hate yourself because you break down and hate somebody. And then you exaggerate that, and I must be horrible. I'm not a good person at all. I'm a horrible person. Where when you're looking at it in terms of Dhamma, then you're seeing, well, you know, hating people is also a condition that arises and ceases and is not self. And in terms of action and speech, we don't act on it, but we're certainly aware of it. And you're no longer identifying with it. Because that's where in Buddhism, what I found very useful for me was that morality is in regards to action and speech rather than thought. Where I was brought up to think that you had immoral thoughts and therefore you're an immoral person because you have immoral thoughts. But in Buddhism, immorality comes through action and speech, not through thought. So sometimes you have, you know, bad thoughts, immoral thoughts, or thoughts that are, you know, considered immoral, dirty thoughts and whatever, and then you have gross desires and so forth that you can consider as bad, but you're but you're aware of them in terms of Dhamma. Then you're in that position of seeing and knowing rather than of just reacting and complicating it all. Seeing it as, I shouldn't think like that, I shouldn't feel like that, I'm horrible for even thinking such a thought. The way that one can feel guilty and hate oneself over what might be coming up in your consciousness. Yes, in Buddhist countries, it's considered a blessing to be a human being. That's a good point. You know, it's a fortunate birth. It's because of all your good actions in previous lives that you're a human being. That's a different way of looking at it. And thinking Adam and Eve, through their weakness, we're suffering. We're born into this realm. We're already corrupt. And we've got to, somehow this futile idea, you know, we've got to make ourselves, you know, uncorrupt in some way. When we're born, already this idea of being corrupted. But this is where I think, like Dr. Vajrayana is coming from this meeting in this Benedictine monastery in Kentucky, because you find in I've been to some meetings in Catholic or Anglican monasteries, and especially amongst monastics, Anglican monastics or Roman Catholic, there's a common ground, and monasticism has a kind of common bond to it. You appreciate each other. Just the fact that monks and nuns, you know, regardless of the particular religion, and then also because monasticism is a contemplative life. Especially in Roman Catholicism, there's a real searching going on for, a maturing. Because one always felt that Christianity tried to keep, you know, like I could see that the reason why I rebelled against it was that I was presented with a very infantile version of Christianity. And it didn't grow up, you know. I grew up, but God was still an old man, patriarch, and didn't change. I mean, when you grow up, you know, you can believe that, and you know, like you're Santa Claus or something. You certain age, you believe in Santa Claus, and then you get another age, and you don't believe in Santa Claus. You just can't believe in Santa Claus anymore. So then I thought the image of God and the perceptions that I was given were still very childlike, childish ones. And so I had to look somewhere else because I couldn't find it within the Christian context that I grew up in. But now you feel there is a, like you see it in Italy and in here in Britain, in America, much more a kind of awareness and openness and where God now is. I mean, I've heard Christian monks talk about God as no thing. In fact, a few years back in this room, Anglican monk from Oxford was here, and he was talking, and he's saying, God is no thing. He's proclaiming it. And of course, many there's an interfaith meeting. Some people are very upset by that because it sounded like a denial of God. You know, like you're denying God or you're destroying God. But for Buddhists, that is quite, you know, one can relate to that and appreciate that. But this monk was meaning, he wasn't meaning a rejection or denial or destruction, but a much more mature and mystical relationship, mystical experience. Yeah, you know, and that, and oftentimes that's where you're not supposed to make images of God, even in Christianity. You know, you're not supposed to make images of God, like in you can make images of Christ. Or saints, or like in Buddhism, you can make images of Buddha, but you can't make images of Dhamma. You make symbols like Dhammajaka or wheels and that, but Dhamma has never been personified never been anthropomorphized. It always remains Dhamma as a realization rather than as a of personification, where the personification comes through Buddha rather than through Dhamma. Then Sangha also is the, like the church or the congregation, those who practice, the practicers. So that like we can relate to Sangha when we're practicing, when we're as refuge in the community of people, of those who are practicing, because the ultimate is ineffable, and you're getting beyond the form and conditions. Roshi. If she were Hindu, she'd be a Rishi. In Zen, she'd be a Roshi. that's where, you feel there is this, you know, that religious conventions aren't, denials of each other. Or that you have to reject one and by becoming another. It's not, like in terms of Dhamma, you don't feel that you have to reject Christianity or Judaism or anything. It's not like you, to be a Buddhist, you have to promise you're not a Christian anymore, because you're getting outside that whole realm of becoming something. So you're not looking at it in terms of to become a Buddhist, you have to believe this and you can't believe that. But you're actually looking at that very process of believing or not believing in things. Well, that, like the mystical forms of any religion are, is where you're realizing non-duality. Then the conventional forms can be very dualistic. So you like fundamentalism of fundamentalist approaches to religion tend to be dualistic. This is right and that's wrong. Absolutizing of the relative. This is, we're right, you're wrong. Our way is right, your way. If you don't agree with our way, then you're wrong. That's like fundamentalism. And you see it, I see it in Buddhism sometimes, I see it in Christianity, Islam, it has this sense of, it's very divisive, you know. We're right, you're wrong. There's no room for discussion. then the contemplative forms are, you know, you can see with Catholicism, this meeting in Kentucky and so forth. Then you're coming on working on a contemplative level, not from the dualistic one. So there's you're not fixed in you're not committed to or attached to the symbols of your religion anymore. You're not operating from fixed positions, but from more reflection and contemplation. And then mystical experience is something that you experience directly. So it's not a matter of anyone else being able to tell you what it is. But you know, oftentimes we explain it in the language that we have from our religion. So you have, like in Buddhism, the whole Buddhist language is very aimed at that, trying and being able to talk about or to think in a way that is, say, not just coming from the basic illusions of your cultural background. But then you read about the Christian mystics and their experience, you know, even though they may be talking in a very Christian way about their experience, you're not just interpreting the words in a very doctrinal way. You're getting a feeling for what they're actually saying, and in that more intuitive feeling, more intuitive understanding, then you don't feel it. It's different. Or that there's a Christian ultimate truth and a Buddhist ultimate truth. You know, it doesn't. Remember when Ajahn Chah was in England in 1979, we went to this place in Sussex, a seminary or something, and I remember Matt asking, Ajahn Chah, is the Buddhist ultimate truth different from the Christian ultimate truth? And Ajahn Chah looks, he says, how can there be two ultimate truths? Well, those kind of religions are, they're basically, we're right, you're wrong. So, I mean, they're very committed to, you know, in some ways they're operating out of compassion, because they feel you're wrong, they want to help you to be right. But so they, in one way, they mean well, but they don't have much wisdom in their religion, so that they operate from ideas. You know, they aren't aware of what how things are. They're coming from the ideas that they get. That are conditioning their habits. Well, because if you're coming from anger and hatred, then it tends to create that in the person you're talking to. But if you're not, if you wait till the anger passes, then you've got a stronger position. Because then you're not, because if I get angry with you, and you're not mindful, and you'll get angry back, and we just fight. We're not listening to each other. We're just reacting. Yeah. But if I get angry with you, and you don't react with anger, and you wait till your anger's gone, and then that helps me, in fact, because then I can get, you know, I can. You're not feeding that in me, and then I'm capable of maybe, it's more possible to hear what you're saying. But if I'm just reacting to you, then I don't even hear what you're saying. I'm just picking up, you know. She hates me, and you can't even hear. Maybe you've got something important to tell me, but because you're angry, I can't even hear what you're saying. You know, I hear it maybe on one level, emotionally, I can't, I only picking up the anger and hatred you feel towards me. That's why I found, you know, like in living in community, when I react in anger to somebody, even though I'm saying, you know, maybe they're doing something really stupid, and I'm coming from anger and aversion to them, they pick up the anger and aversion. That's what they remember, not the good advice that I'm giving them. That's why but sometimes, you know, like a strong approach does have, you know, but I found sometimes you can use a kind of fierceness which to make a point, but to make it really effective is you can't really be angry when you're doing it. Or like, you know, when your mother seeing her little child run out in the street, you know, she's got to make a strong statement. She's got to, don't! And she says, now, dear, you mustn't go out in the street. The little kid might not understand not realize the danger. Concern and not hatred, but concern. Yeah, very strong. Bowls you over. Especially a big bloke like me. So I think that's enough for this afternoon. And next week, Ajahn Vridhamo will give the talk, because I'm leading a retreat, Thai retreat, next weekend. So, but please, we're all invited to come next Sunday.